Today on Straight Talk Africa, a discussion and analysis on the state of human rights in the African Great Lakes region. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are discussing human rights in Africa's Great Lakes region. In 2019, human rights demonstrations were plentiful across Africa, while the causes of the protesters' grievances are varied. Many were often met with a harsh response from security forces. VOA producer Paul Ndiho has more in this report, narrated by Zoe Liudaki.
In Sudan and Guinea, demonstrators were frustrated with the governing of long-time entrenched leaders. In Zimbabwe, angry protesters mostly vented over poor economic conditions. Human Rights Watch released its most recent report card on Africa in Johannesburg last month.
We've seen, I think, the average men and women of the African continent taking agency, being agents for their own, for the changes they wanted to see. We saw an increase of peaceful protest in different countries. The second, I think, takeaway is that we've also seen a backsliding from government in terms of political and civic space.
In Rwanda, six members of the opposition United Democratic Forces of Rwanda party, formerly led by Victoire Ingabire, are in jail after being convicted of forming an illegal armed group and conspiring against the government. Ingabire is an outspoken critic of President Paul Kagame, who served 6 years of a 15-year prison term before being released in 2018. Now the government is allegedly detaining and abusing children, but the government is denying such accusations. A United Nations report on ethnic violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo reveals documented killings that may rise to the level of crimes against humanity and possibly even genocide. For nearly two decades, the DRC has been the scene of sporadic, deadly ethnic conflict. The UN says violence in Congo has claimed millions of lives.
The report says the barbarity that characterizes these attacks, including the beheading of women and children with machetes, the dismemberment and removal of body parts of the victims as trophies of war, reflects the desire of the attackers to inflict lasting trauma on the Hema communities and to force them to flee and not to return to their villages.
President Felix Tshisekedi is promising to end violence and has called for a national reconciliation. But his critics say that that's not good enough. Meanwhile, violence in Eastern Congo continues to rage with no apparent end in sight. Last September, the United Nations warned that in Burundi, police, security forces, and their ruling party's youth league, the Imbonerakure, were committing severe human rights violations. Despite President Pierre Nkurunziza's announcement that he would not run in the presidential election in 2020, tension has continued to rise. The Human Rights Watch report says that in Uganda, in 2019, the situation remained static with violations of freedom of association, assembly, and expression. The government arrested its opponents and blocked political and student rallies. The government's continued failure to ensure accountability of abuses does not bode well for a country heading into 2021 general elections. The United States dropped Cameroon from the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act over allegations of human rights violations in its English-speaking regions. The crisis has cost more than 3,000 lives and displaced more than 500,000 civilians from their homes. But The Deputy Africa Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch says in terms of human rights, overall, Africa is moving in the right direction.
Who could have thought al-Bashir in Sudan would be overthrown? Who could have thought that would happen in Nigeria, in Africa? We're sort of looking at the Arab Spring. So people are being more aware of their rights to demonstrate, to protest.
Across Africa, hope for improvement in human rights is on the rise. Since taking power in 2018, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has implemented sweeping political reforms that won him the Nobel Peace Prize for his restoration of friendly relations with longtime foe Eritrea. For Paul Ndiho, I'm Zoe Liudaki, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report narrated by Zoe Liudaki. Joining me today in Washington are two distinguished guests, Claude Gatebuke, co-founder and executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network, Jean-Paul Ruhosha, executive director of Congo Today, and from New York, we are joined by Ida Sawyer, deputy director for Africa at the Human Rights Watch. Well, I have to say, Ida, Claude, and Jean-Paul, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Shaka. Thank you. Profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled also.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. You look terrific in that gorgeous shirt.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm trying to keep up with you.
Thank you, Shaka.
You're most welcome, Jean-Paul. Now, let me, in fact, shoot the first question to you, since you have a gorgeous shirt on. You come from the beautiful Asaland, Roaring Hills, beautiful country of Rwanda.
Yes.
What is the state of human rights in that republic?
The analogy that I would use for what's happening in terms of human rights in Rwanda and in the region is the heart of Africa is bleeding, because there is so much egregious violations of human rights in the country from the top to the bottom. I'll give you a few examples. Just last week, a report came out. We've known this for a long time, of basically people being criminalized for being poor, beggars,
street vendors. What do you mean for being poor?
So Rwanda's known for having the cleanest streets and everything, you know, a very beautiful, clean country. But the cost has been the violations of human rights, where people are rounded up, street children, street vendors, homeless people, and other people being rounded up and taken to these detention centers, one in Gikondo known as Kwagachinya. It's basically a torture chamber. They're held there, no trials, and then they're thrown back on the streets and they are rearrested again to keep the streets clean, to keep a nice image.
To keep
on
the,
top of that.
To keep the streets clean. Clean for who?
Clean for the foreigners and the visitors and the tourists.
And the Rwandan elite?
And yes, the Rwandan leaders, the elite and the rich. Additionally, in December, just a little bit before Christmas, poor people's houses were destroyed. And what they said was the reason they destroyed those houses, and there was no place for them to go. Some of them were basically homeless right outside of their homes because of the placement of their homes on the hills. And they were saying that it's in anticipation of the rains not taking the houses down. So instead of the rains themselves destroying those houses, mm-hmm. the government hired people to come and actually destroy the homes with no place for those families to go. Some of those families are still homeless today. And I can go on and on. This is just inside of Rwanda. People's families continue to report on a daily basis their family members and their loved ones going missing. And as far as when you go beyond that, the day-to-day life, the elites, the people in politics, there's no opposition. Anyone in opposition that's legitimate opposition has been jailed. Obviously, there was the release of a few members of new formed party Dalfa Umurinzi that is that was formed by Victoire Ingabire recently, but a number of her members, members of her party, are still imprisoned on trumped-up charges.
We'll get to that and more later. What about you, Jean-Paul? You were here not a long time ago talking about pretty much the same thing.
Exactly.
Are you telling me that nothing has changed since then?
Actually, it became worse than what it was last time. Last time we talked about preventing it, even though it was going on already. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, nothing that the government did. Right now, the government actually is open to kill the people. We talk about South Kivu. I'm talking about South Kivu Banyamulenge. This last time, the where the MONUSCO is, there is a Banyamulenge who have been killed there. In Zero, I showed you the cardiography and the map.
But the government says that, on the contrary, it is a servant of the people.
Unfortunately, it's not at this time. They get umbrella of Mai Mai. There is a Mai Mai in coalition. What I seen on the report of Human Rights, it didn't include all the details.
What is Mai Mai? You keep talking about Mai Mai, and Mai Mai has featured very prominently, especially during the last decades of civil wars in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It is sometimes referred to as a militia, and sometimes referred to as an ethnic group or community or something. What exactly is Mai Mai?
Mai Mai, it's a coalition of the other ethnics, which is Bafulero, Babembe, Banyindu, mm-hmm. and Bavira. They mm-hmm. have a coalition as an army.
And what does Mai Mai mean? Does it mean water or what?
It means water.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it means water.
Like Maji Maji in the context of Tanzania.
Exactly. It's that context. But what they do, it's killing people. And now they form the coalition with Redi Tabara and the FNL and the Forebu. Those are Burundian rebels.
And why are they killing people?
Good question. They are killing people. Why? They wanted to do what I will call uprooted, which is, in French, I can call it déracinement.
Wait a minute. The primary audience of Straight Talk Africa is English.
Exactly. Which is what I'm saying. It's uprooted. It's the people. They want to get all the Banyamulenge mm-hmm. out of Congo. And for them to do that, they have this deal that they did with all the Burundian and the Mai Mai, mm-hmm. so they can kick Banyamulenge out of the South Kivu and the whole entire country. So for
and
them,
are they simply targeting Banyamulenge?
Extremely Banyamulenge. I saw what Human Rights Watch did, but they didn't include all the details.
And who is targeting the Hema?
Who's targeting the Hema? It's by Hendu. That are trying to do that. And the Hema also are Tutsi. Remember that we have the same issue. And all this is because they think that we are not Congolese, even though President Felix Tshisekedi said we are Congolese, even though I'm not really impressed by his speech saying that we are not citizen seekers. We were there before Congo was there. Banyamulenge were there before Congo became Congo.
As a matter of fact, sir, when you talk about Congo, it reminds me of, again, the Berlin 1884 conference.
Exactly. Before that happened,
okay.
the Banyamulenge were there. The Hema were there.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no any reason for Soha Weaver to violate those rights of them, to kick them out. That's a fundamental right to have them. And the strategy...
But these are
using.
Colonial political expressions, really.
Exactly. How they
Why would an African be, for example, a foreigner in Africa?
That's what's happening there, Shaka. And what they are trying to do, they are trying to kick them out, to get them out of their land. They've been burning their houses, taking their cows away. And you know they are farmers. And they've been destroying all their houses, everything they have, they belong to. So what they are doing exactly is it's a strategy to kick them out of the country completely.
So would you agree with some who actually suggest that what you're looking at is a conflict between the whole for those who are cultivators and the cow.
No,
because the cow is looking for unfettered access to grass and water and all that kind of stuff.
Let me explain what they're doing. This is a political deal. When you look at it, they're using so-called Maimai and the so-called Redi Tabara and all that.
When you say they are, who are they?
I will tell you that it's a government of Congo.
A government?
Yes. And we have evidence of FRDC, the Army of Congo, doing that to the people, openly kill Banyamulenge, and saying that we are not here to protect you. We are actually here to escort you to Rwanda, as they think that Rwanda is the country that's where the Banyamulenge come from. It's the same issue that happened in Nyumba, what Human Rights did report about.
You have incontrovertible evidence on that?
Unfortunately, I didn't bring them, but last time I submitted it to that, and which is what we are working on right now to prove that. And I was trying to get in contact with AIDA to show that, so we can document those incontrovertible evidence, as you said, that could provide those people could go in jail and justice could be served for Banyamulenge and the other people in the Congo.
Who are your primary sources?
The people.
Which people?
The Banyamulenge who are there, who have been a victim of that, and the Bafurero and the Babembe who are not belong on that kind of deal.
And what about the Bashi?
And the Bashi also. The Bashi also, there is a Bashi who are against this kind of deal and who are openly talking about these deals every single day. And Shaka, this is causing a big issue. I think it's going to cause the whole entire region the problem. This may affect Rwanda. This may affect Burundi. Remember, there is an election coming up in Burundi, the presidential election, which might be worse than what we believe we've been seeing. It's happening in Banyamulenge right now because they are victim of that. What they want, actually, they want to get the land so that they can have as their base of the strategy the world to fight Burundi. This is Redi Tabara. Remember, Redi Tabara, it's those who did attempted coup to Burundi and they failed. But they formed the coalition between them and the Mai Mai to kill Banyamulenge.
Let's hear from AIDA. Good afternoon, AIDA.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I think looking more broadly at the human rights situation in Congo, we are extremely worried. I think there was a lot of hope that things would change significantly with the transition and with Felix Tshisekedi coming into power, but a lot of promises were made. Some improvements happened. A number of political opposition leaders and activists living in exile were able to return. Political prisoners were released, and President Tshisekedi has made a lot of promises. But so far, we're yet to see a lot of change on the ground. And the situation in the east, as Jean was just describing, is extremely worrying, including in Minembwe, in that area, with the attacks on Banyamulenge and the inter-ethnic conflicts there. But across eastern Congo, there are still some 130 armed groups that are active, and abuses by these groups, as well as by the Congolese army, against the civilian population. And one of our big concerns is that the abusive commanders of the army who were there under Kabila's regime are still in power, including many who have been sanctioned by the UN Security Council and the United States and the European Union, and who have long records of involvement in serious human rights abuses, attacks on civilians, and support to armed groups. And these officers are still playing a key role in eastern Congo, and we have reports that some of them are continuing to support armed groups and undermine efforts to bring peace and stability to eastern Congo. So we feel it's really crucial for these officers to be removed from their positions of power if we really want to make progress in ending all of this violence in the east.
Aida, you talk about the transition in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, but there are some sources which say, on the contrary, what you saw as a transition was probably a facade. They argue that when you look at President Felix Tshisekedi, you are talking about a man that has a position and rank with no authority. How do you respond to that?
I think we all saw what happened during the elections in late 2018 and after the leaked data that came out from the Electoral Commission and from the Catholic Church Observation Mission showed that Martin Fayulu, the leader of the Lamuka Coalition, won overwhelmingly in the vote. But in the end, the presidency was not given to him. It was given to Felix Tshisekedi, another opposition leader, while former President Kabila's coalition, the FCC, maintained control over parliament. And when the government was eventually appointed in September of last year, Kabila's coalition retains a majority of positions there. And up until now, the security forces are still largely controlled by officers who were part of Kabila's regime and could still be loyal to him. So while Felix Tshisekedi, who, you know, I think the all indications are that he has, you know, good intentions and he would like to see the situation improve, he himself has, you know, no record of involvement in serious human rights abuses, and I think he wants to make things better for the Congolese people and to have a good record, but he up until now his ability to implement change is limited, given that he doesn't have the control over parliament or the government, all of the ministers and the security forces. But it, you know, remains to be seen. He's called this year the year of action. He's traveled a lot to try to gain support internationally and regionally. And if he, you know, he is now president, if he wants to act to make changes in the security forces, to push investigations forward regarding corruption allegations, make progress in the fight against impunity for serious crimes, he does have the authority to do that. And we and others have urged him to try to act and try to really change the system and show that he is independent and different from the former Kabila regime, which was associated with so many widespread human rights abuses.
Good intentions indeed. How can you talk about good intentions when the individual does not in fact wield authority, wield power? He cannot move any mountains.
Well, he is the president. He has done some steps. He removed, for example, Caleb Mouton, who was the head of the ANR, the intelligence services, last March. He was, you know, seen by many to be the architect of repression under Kabila and responsible for crackdown on the opposition and peaceful protesters and activists. So removing him from his position of power was an important step. We would like them to go further and open investigations into all of the abuses he was allegedly involved in and responsible for, but that was one step. And I think if he has the courage and the will to act, he could take similar steps to sideline some of the other abusive security force commanders who still maintain senior positions of power. And he can allow and encourage the justice system to operate independently. On corruption, there are some investigations that are going forward. We would like to see more progress on investigating and trying to prosecute serious war crimes, crimes against humanity that have been committed, including by some of these officers and the security forces, but also armed group leaders who, you know, some of whom are wanted on arrest warrants, like Guidon. He's the leader of an armed group that controls much of what Masisi and Walikali territories in North Kivu, and his troops have been responsible for recruitment of children and ethnic massacres, mass rapes, widespread violations. And if there is a will, the Congolese authorities could move to arrest him and bring him to justice, and that would be an important step in the right direction and have a real impact for people living in these territories.
Very interesting. Claude, you were in Rwanda during and immediately after the genocide.
Yes.
The first post-Rwandan genocide president was a gentleman called Pasteri Bizimungu.
Yes.
He was president. He was son excellence. What else did he have, really?
He had the title, but he didn't have the power.
He had a title. He could essentially he could enjoy pomp and pageantry, but could he, in fact, make even the most basic of decisions?
No. All the decisions were coming from the vice president. And at the time, the vice president was current president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. So he was just a figurehead at the time. And of course, yes, in terms of ceremonial and going to the ceremonies with the title of president, he could do that. But the decision making and everything in terms of ruling the country, it was being done by the vice president. When he was overthrown, the post of vice presidency was removed in the country. But the thing I want to add to what the comments that everyone made is you cannot talk about the human rights violations and the massacres and all of the belligerence in the Congo without talking about Rwanda and Uganda, the roles of the Rwandan military and the Ugandan military in eastern Congo. And, by the way, one of the things that the current president of Congo, Tshisekedi, has really, in my opinion, messed up on was allowing the Rwandan military to be able to enter the Congo and operate there.
So basically, what you are saying here, though, you are contradicting yourself. If, in fact, President Tshisekedi did have that kind of power, but to allow the Rwandan army to come in on to Congolese territory, then it seems to me he's exercising power.
He signed the papers. Just like
exactly,
President like Bizimungu was signing the papers. But we know who holds power in Congo today is still Kabila. He controls the whole government. And he was installed in the Congo by Rwandan troops. You look at the parliament in Congo. Look at the impunity that he has.
He will tell you that his party won the election.
Exactly. And he still has impunity, right? Did they win the election based on the reports that we saw? Tshisekedi didn't win the election. And Tshisekedi was installed by Kabila. And today, the same deals that Kabila made with Kagame, Tshisekedi is making the same deals. And that makes eastern Congo really dangerous. The Red Tabara that you were talking about is sponsored by Rwanda. The rebels that were trying to overthrow the Burundian government in 2015, they weren't rebels then, but they were expelled from Burundi or ran away from Burundi, went into refugee camps in Rwanda, and then the government of Rwanda started conscripting them into a militia to invade Burundi. And now they're over in the Congo. It's the same militias committing the atrocities against the Banyamulenge. Now, back to the Banyamulenge. They were also used back in the 90s by the Rwanda military to invade the Congo, commit genocide against the refugees, the Rwandan refugees who were there, go all the way across the Congo. Since that invasion, millions of people have been killed since that invasion. Now, General James Kabarebe,
Banyamulenge.
They were calling themselves Banyamulenge.
But they are not Banyamulenge.
There is no way.
Were those your relatives?
Yes, but they didn't commit genocide. I will correct. They used the name. That's what he said.
Exactly.
But not Banyamulenge committed genocide. And that's what caused most of the bad image. If you saw the report that just came up from Genocide Watch, they described that what he said in 1996, the war of 1996, to take off Mobutu Sese Seko. And in
1996, Mobutu was basically removed.
Yes,
was by foreign forces.
Exactly, that's what he's talking about, and that's when they used name of Banyamulenge, and again they used the same name in 1998 when President Kabila did crap with the Rwandan regime by the time. And then that's how they formed what's called RCD by the time, which was led by Mbusa Nyamwisa and later on Ruberwa, Azarias Ruberwa. But it didn't...
He was one of the four vice presidents.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And at that time, what they used the name of Banyamulenge, and they fought, they had a half of the country by the time. But again, there was a coalition between Banyamulenge by the time with Rwanda, which caused a bad image, especially according to the report of Genocide Watch on Banyamulenge, the image of Banyamulenge. But again, clearly Banyamulenge never did the genocide to any Congolese because they are Congolese, they believe they are Congolese. Let me go back on what Aida said on good intention of Félix Tshisekedi. Félix Tshisekedi have no good intention to resolve the issue at all. I have the evidence of this. We did offer him the plan and the strategy to prevent the killings, and I think I have the evidence of the document that I did send it to him, and the Congo Today did, and the many activists did send it to him to prevent what's going on in Congo, especially in South Kivu. But he never have any intention to do that. And he has power. Don't get twisted that President Tshisekedi doesn't have power. He is the chief, he's the commander-in-chief of DRC Army and everything else. He's a president.
But without authority.
That who measures the authority? He gives the order, he can remove a military to the position.
But
to
wait
the
a minute, we already agreed that the man enjoys the position and rank, pomp and pageantry, but does not have willed authority.
I will contradict that to say that he has no willingness to resolve the issue, but he has the power to prevent what was happening. I can tell you that I have information. If he just repressed a commander who was in South Kivu to another commander, it was going to prevent 350 Banyamulenge who were killed in this last 2 months ago. It was going to prevent 200,000 houses that they took from them. It was going to prevent all those houses they burned down. But he never had that intention to do. I met with him here in Washington, D.C. I explained to him. I gave him the strategy. I went to the people that I think they could know him.
And what
they
did he say?
He promised to do that, but he never did. He even to send a simple letter to say, okay, we are going to reconcile these people, he never did. Because I was in contact with Bafurero, Babembe, Banyindu, all those leaders. And what did we ask him to do? We asked him to give order as a president of the republic to get Reddy Tabara out.
Thank you.
Of the thing. And the Reddy Tabara, it's not only violation of human rights. Give me 1 second, violation of that, but also it's against the Constitution of Congo, Article 52 and Article 51.
Jean-Paul, unfortunately, there is no democracy in Studio 47. When the producer says go, you have to go as a good soldier. You are tuned in to Straight Talk Africa, and we'll have more of our discussion in a moment. So please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, protection, patronage, or plunder? A new book examines how colonialism influenced the development of the Ugandan Kingdom of Buganda. On the next Straight Talk Africa.
And today we are discussing human rights in Africa's Great Lakes region. Our guests are Claude Gatebuke, co-founder and executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network, Jean-Paul Ruhosha, executive director of Congo Today, and in New York City, we are joined by Aida Sawyer, Deputy Director for Africa at the Human Rights Watch. Well, Ida, Claude, and Jean-Paul, once again, I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Thank you, Shaka, for keeping Africa Hope alive.
You're most welcome. You're most welcome. And let me come to you, Ida. Ida, you seem to be under very serious criticism here, especially from your fellow panelist, Jean-Paul, talking about you said that you thought that the DRC president, Felix Tshisekedi, may have good intentions. How do you know, for example, that he may in fact have good intentions? Do you have the ability to read his heart, or has he at some point told you that he does?
Well, I don't know, you know, exactly what's in his head, but I have met with President Tshisekedi since he came into office, and he did make a number of commitments about what he hoped to do. He's made public commitments. Even before he was president, as an opposition leader, he had made some commitments about wanting to improve the situation. But that doesn't mean that he has the ability or the courage or the will to take the actions that are needed to actually make those changes a reality and really end the human rights abuses, improve the situation for the people across Congo. So I think that, you know, remains to be seen. And again, you know, around the what's happening in eastern Congo, as long as these abusive commanders are leading operations and his military and security advisors are those individuals with long records of serious involvement in human rights abuses, I don't think we're going to see real change on the ground. So I think a key first step needs to be taking action to sideline those abusive commanders and looking at a new strategy, not just repeating the same strategies that we've seen year after year in eastern Congo, including, for example, this idea of doing joint operations with the Rwandan army. What we've seen for the past 2.5 decades, whenever the Rwandan army intervenes in eastern Congo, whether it's to support a rebellion in the east or whether it's to deploy officially and carry out operations supposedly against armed groups, the FDLR and others, it's always the Congolese civilian population who pays the price and who suffers the most. So I think that is a very dangerous strategy, and I hope that it doesn't, you know, move forward too much further, because we've seen in the past what cost the Congolese people could pay.
Now, Ida, Let's not just stick on the Congo. Let's also visit the Republic of Rwanda a bit. You had earlier allegations coming from Claude Gatebuke about the violation of human rights in Rwanda. What would you say about Rwanda from your vantage point?
Yeah, I think, you know, I would agree with Claude that the violations are really from the top to the bottom, and there is no political space for independent voices to speak out, to document human rights abuses in Rwanda. No really independent opposition is able to operate. And we've seen, you know, at the top just in the past year, in 2019, we documented several opposition leaders and a journalist who either disappeared or were found dead in mysterious circumstances. People, again and again, people who speak out attempt to criticize the RPF or the President Paul Kagame, they are silenced. And it's incredibly difficult for anyone to criticize government policy. And then we've also seen, you know, at the bottom rung of society, we put out a report that Claude mentioned just last month of how street children and sex workers, street vendors have been rounded up and thrown into these so-called transit centers. We documented especially the case of this Gikondo transit center, where kids are held in deplorable conditions. They don't have access to a lawyer. They aren't charged with the crime. But some of them are held for months, with little food, little access to health care. there. And this is, you know, the other side, as Claude mentioned, of the clean city streets of Kigali that Rwanda likes to present to visitors and others. But this is coming at a price. We've also documented, in recent years, we put out a report about how suspected petty criminals, in rural parts of Rwanda were summarily executed. People who were accused of stealing bananas or stealing a bicycle or a cow were rounded up and killed by security officials, and apparently in an attempt to send a message that if you do anything wrong or if you resist authority, this is the price you can pay. We also continue to document illegal detention and allegations of torture, including in unofficial and official military detention facilities of suspected opponents or people suspected of being associated with the FDLR or other armed groups. And they're just held in, you know, incommunicado detention, no access to a lawyer, often without charge, and allegations of serious abuse during detention. So the human rights situation in Rwanda is extremely alarming, and unfortunately we aren't seeing any progress in a positive direction there.
Ida, how do you respond to Rwandan government officials who say that what you are really talking about, that the conclusions of your research that you say you found out are essentially reflections of what they would characterize as creative accounting? Tell us a bit about your methodology.
So we have a very meticulous methodology at Human Rights Watch, and we only publish information after we've confirmed it with numerous sources. We've spoken directly to victims and witnesses and others with information about the alleged abuses that happened. We always contact the Rwandan authorities and share our findings with them in advance of publication. We ask them for their response in an attempt to include their account, their version in our publications. And we stand by our findings. There are, you know, lots of rumors out there and allegations, but we dig further, and we only publish on something once we're very confident and we have numerous sources to back up our findings.
I see. Let me come to you, Claude. There are some who say that in order for someone to be a legitimate and effective leader of a nation, that particular person has to reflect four basic values. These four basic values are basically four C's. Not like the three C's of David Livingston, which essentially the colonialists used as a justification for colonizing Africa. But these three C's are very important in the sense that one C stands for conscious. The second C stands for character. The third C stands for courage. And the fourth C stands for country. Do you see any leader in the Great Lakes region that reflect these four C's?
I would say they're all characters, but they don't reflect the four C's.
What do you mean they're all characters?
In the way they operate, the way they pretend to serve the people, but they really are serving themselves, and they sell these images abroad of, you know, being great leaders, great Pan-Africanists, who in fact are butchering the people inside of the countries that they
their
are ruling.
Their own people.
Yes. And also the people across the borders, in the case of Rwanda and Uganda. You were talking about the region, the Great Lakes region of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say characters, they're actors. They're not genuine in what they present themselves as. Consciousness, there's no humanity.
When we talk about the Great Lakes region.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which countries are we really talking about here besides Rwanda, Democratic Republic of Congo, Uganda. And we're also talking about the Congo Republic, which used to be Congo Brazzaville. Yes. Are we also not talking about Tanzania, for example?
Burundi,
of course.
Kenya.
I still think, looking at the region, no one of those leaders meets the four C's.
No, they're not four C's. The four C's, yes. But there have been some probably in the past who have probably met.
I would say
the four C's.
Julius Nyerere was a good example.
Mm-hmm.
Patrice Lumumba was another good example, very short-lived. And in fact, the removal of Lumumba has set in motion this practice of Western countries, the U.S. and the U.K. and France, installing friendly tyrants and dictators, starting with Mobutu, who served 32 years and bankrupted the Congo, and then was replaced in the region by Museveni and Kagame. The belligerence in the region has the support of the outsiders. People who are not from the region but exploit the region. So it's a much bigger issue. But what we have is what is known in the region as nyamparas, or
meaning
puppets.
Nyampara is a Kiswahili word for puppets.
Yes.
For a foreman.
Right.
The supervisor. Who is essentially organizing the natives on behalf of his masters.
Exactly.
The foreign masters.
And that's what we have in the region. What the leaders that we have, like I say, Julius Nyerere and Patrice Lumumba really met, in my opinion, the four C's. However, the ones that we have today, most of them in that region, are nyamparas. They are serving their puppet masters. And at the expense of the people, the masses are suffering, and the people are used as tools
Very
to access, you know, these resources and for them to keep their favors.
What about you, Jean-Paul?
I strongly believe what he's, I'm with him, what he said. Lumumba was the best leader who worked for the people. Don't forget one thing. You have to, which I will give example for what Aida said. You cannot just talk about what you're going to do. But when it comes to the reality, you are not doing anything. Therefore, you are not going to meet all those forces. What they do, they actually sell themselves out there as if they are business marketing doing. And then they don't serve people.
But look at look at a man, for example, like Major General Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda. I remember a few years ago, a former U.S. president, who happened to be a very good president of the United States, Bill Clinton, was essentially touting him as perhaps one of the world's best leaders, a man who somehow had led his country through very difficult times and had, in Bill Clinton's view, brought about, for example, what he characterized as genuine political reconciliation in Rwanda. And yet the evidence on the ground probably suggests otherwise. And you had also a former British Prime Minister, a good Prime Minister at that, Tony Blair.
So what does that mean?
I'm simply asking you, when these two individuals, who were very good leaders in their own countries, and in fact were respected internationally, when they make that type of endorsement to a man like Paul Kagame, and then you probably look on the ground and say, wait a minute, what is this? What does that mean?
To me, you cannot be, just because of somebody who's in high power and see you as he see him, it doesn't make you to be perfect leader.
No, I'm not looking for perfection.
Let's go on that. And when you say that he did what he did, I believe he did for Rwandans. He did what he did for Rwandans. And which is, he didn't do everything he did, it's not zero. No. There is something he did when it comes to economic development, when it comes to cleaning the city, as he was saying.
You can clean the people out and call it cleaning the city.
Jean-Paul, someone will also tell you that a man called Adolf Hitler did incredible things in Germany. In fact, during his days, Germany was even on the technological cutting edge. He is the man, for example, who came up with the Autobahn, what we now call highways and all that kind of stuff. Mm. They produced Volkswagen, which is supposed to be a people's car. You can talk about Joseph Stalin. Mm. He brought about an incredible development in what was once the Soviet Union, to the extent that it became a superpower.
I think,
but at the end of the day, you have to look at the people. You have to put people at the center.
Exactly. That's what I was going to talk about. We have to measure the leadership of the leaders, how they manage to lead their people. Mm. And that's what we needed to see. Is it President Kagame, what he does in Rwanda, the people are happy about it? Mm. Is it everybody see themselves in that kind of leadership? And there is a democracy that's needed in the country. Can everybody have freedom of speech, freedom of whatever they want to express themselves? Is that happening in Rwanda?
Can a person, for example, have the right to own an opinion that may be different from the government or the ruling party?
Exactly. That's what we can now understand and say, okay, this is a president who are loved by people, who is a good leader, who we can measure that way. But if not, then he's not the right leader that we can see. But on Kagame, maybe he's Rwandese, he will talk about.
Kagame's record shows that he's more in line with Adolf Hitler and the other leader that you mentioned, in terms of, you know, they did all these great development things, but they hurt the people. They hurt millions of people. And he's more along those lines, more so than being a great leader for the people in the country or the region, seeing the millions of people who have been killed in the Congo. And in Rwanda, not just Congo, but inside of Rwanda and in the Congo, since 1990, since Paul Kagame started operating inside of Rwanda, people have been dying daily. People have been killed. No trials, no justice. You can't have an opinion. And that is not a leader that you can, you know, nuance and go by the opinion of a Bill Clinton or a Tony Blair, because
we'll come back to that later.
He might be just a friend of
Bill Clinton. We'll come back to that later. Ida? Hello, yeah. Ida.
I think one thing we're seeing across the Great Lakes region is what, you know, you could call a facade of democracy, where these leaders feel like they need to show to a degree their people, but also these international powers, that they are organizing elections and that they were elected in some sort of process. But it's really all about them just maintaining power. And when you don't allow the opposition to participate in the election, or you don't allow people to hold peaceful protests, peaceful demonstrations, when you lock up journalists, when you lock up pro-democracy activists, when you fire on demonstrators, that's not a democratic process. That's not a credible election. So I think, and then you also have them changing their constitutions to remove term limits, to allow them to stay in power for longer and longer. And I think there needs to be much more from international players to look at the conditions of the elections, and not just, it shouldn't just be a box-ticking exercise to see if a so-called election happened, but you need to look at this broader context and see if basic freedoms are respected to make the process credible, and to see whether the people really had a say in deciding the country's future and who the country's leaders are.
Good point. Well, how do you respond to some people who say that you really cannot eat this thing called democracy? That it is better perhaps to emphasize service delivery than democracy. Is it possible that perhaps service delivery and democracy are mutually exclusive? and not mutually reinforcing?
No, I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think that part of the problem is just insisting on the technical process of holding election, but not putting enough attention around the climate that makes a credible election possible and making sure that people's basic freedoms are respected and people are able to voice their opinions, they're able to participate in a democratic process. And I think if the focus is on building from the bottom up to ensure that those basic freedoms are respected and organizing an election in that context, it makes service delivery easier and it makes development possible. But I think if you just insist on the box-ticking exercise of an election, you could do some service delivery, but at the end, if people feel like they don't have a voice, they aren't able to speak out, they don't have their basic freedoms, that's a big price to pay for some development.
You know, Ida, during colonialism, these countries had a police force. And indeed, the institution was called a police force because, in fact, its role was to force the natives, essentially, to service the colonial system. And when these countries regained political independence, some of these countries changed their constitutions and changed the wording and called it police service, meaning the police institution as a law enforcement agency was in fact supposed to be serving the people. And yet, when you look at the behavior, nothing really has changed. So
yeah, I think it's clear that so much of the abuse that we are seeing today by the police and other security services, you can see the roots in the colonial legacy and all of the abuse that that characterized the colonial regimes. And these regimes were all about just profiting the colonial master and taking out the resources and using the people of these countries essentially as slaves or forced labor to bring profit to the colonial powers. And when you had the transitions that eventually happened to independence, a lot of these security services sort of continued in the same practices that some of the colonial forces used, where they were more preying on the population instead of protecting the population.
Well, unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. And on that note, our guests today were Claude Gatebuke, Jean-Paul Ruhosha, and Ida Soya. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not beater, the Great Lakes region. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.